Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks, offering cool climate wines that capture the essence of Oregon since 2002. This episode features Micah Lewis in conversation with Hannah Rosen. Rosen is an author, journalist, and radio host, and Lewis, of course, is considered one of the greatest nonfiction writers of our time. His first book, Liar's Poker, was an instant bestseller, and since then he has taken on a huge variety of subjects, from the Oakland A's in his book Moneyball to Wall Street in The Big Short. His latest book, The Undoing Project, is about the invention of a whole field of psychology, commonly referred to as behavioral economics. What matters about Lewis's work is how artfully he illuminates the messiness of life, that skill, luck, and coincidence often collide in producing some of our most profound moments. The conversation is wide-ranging in that Rosen and he talk not only about his recent work, but also about the behind-the-scenes stories that led him to write his most popular books and how some of them came to be films. Here's Rosen and Lewis.
Han and I haven't seen each other in a long time, but we were colleagues at the New Republic in 95, 96. I was a senior editor, though I was senior to no one and I edited nothing. And Hanna was a reporter researcher.
Yeah. Do you remember our actual connection? I don't know if Michael remembers this story, and I hope never to remind you of it. I house sat for you one time.
Oh, that's right.
And I house sat for you, and I had a party at your house, which I didn't tell you about. And the reason you found out about it, because there was voicemail at the time, and when you came home from wherever you were, there were like 99 messages on the machine. Hey, can you let me in? I'm bringing the buzzer here. Because I'd like cleaned up. I put everything away. You know, I had it spick and span, but I forgot about the voicemail. So
all right, we'll talk
anyway,
about
you were pretty nice about it. All right. Any movie that's been made of any of your books that you think is better than the book?
So it's been interesting to me, this collision of my stories with Hollywood, because I never would have predicted it was going to happen. For years I sold stuff and nothing ever got made. I'll tell you a funny story. Billy Bean, who Brad Pitt played in Moneyball, Billy Bean in 2003 when Moneyball came out was furious with me about the book for about 2 minutes. And he was furious because he calls and he said, you can't have me saying f*** so much. My mother's going to be upset and all that. And he didn't like all the attention. And he gets this call from a movie company saying they want to buy his life rights. And he calls me and says, I just want to let you know there's no way I'm letting this happen. I'm not selling my life rights to a movie studio. And I got this book has created a misery in my life. I don't want any more attention. And I said, it doesn't work that way. They never make the movie. They give you money for the rights,
uh-huh.
And you get an option. Like you're gonna get tens of thousands of dollars every year so they re-up the option until they decide they can figure out how to make a movie of it.
Uh-huh.
And he made me list all of the projects I had like that where they're just giving me money for nothing. And he said, this is incredible. I mean, the movie business works. and he says, they'll really do this. And I said, yeah. He says, all right, I'll sign it. So he signed it and sent it in. And every year he'd call and he'd say, this is just the greatest thing. I got another check. And he says, you're right. It's like, this went on for 7 years. And the eighth year he called and he said, you son of a He said, Brad Pitt wants to come over to my house and my wife is putting on makeup and the babysitter's wearing a dress. And he was, so the collision, I didn't see this coming.
Uh-huh.
The Blind Side, Moneyball, and The Big Short, there have been three movies made. And what has struck me is, first, it's such a different thing. A movie is such a different thing from a book. As a form, it's more like a short story. So that there's a matter of a huge compression and elimination,
right,
that goes on, and editing that goes on. And two, when they do it, the people who are doing this and do this for a living, they often base their work on books. They really, really prefer the author to be dead.
Yeah.
They do not want you there, like saying you ruined my work of art, or saying you should do this, do that. They, And so they don't, but there's this very odd thing that goes on. They don't want you, because you're alive, inconveniently, they want you to approve. And so they bring you into the process and pretend to be interested in what you have to say. And your job, if you're just a decent person, is to pretend to believe that they're interested in what you have to say. So you have this thing. So I've watched all three of them, I thought, were different from the book.
What did they give? Did they let you read the script, or are you just on set one day saying, like, oh, fine job, or what's your
They let you read, they send you the script, they ask what you think of the script, they ignore what you say about the script, then they ask you to come to the set because they want to make sure that you're, and so you go to the set, and it's fun. I mean, really funny things can happen on these sets, but you're not participating in any way. Mm-hmm. And then you go, I mean, it's different in each case. I've gotten to know the actors and the directors real well, mainly because they want you to sell it at the back end. And so you go on the, and they've all been nominated for awards, so you're looped into the whole award season. Mm-hmm. And this is an odd thing about Hollywood. The people who make movies, they'll spend 3 months making a movie and then 9 months campaigning for an award for the movie. And the vast majority of the talent, the best talent in Hollywood, the vast majority of the time is not doing their job because they're campaigning for awards for doing their job. And yeah, it's a hugely inefficient business this way.
Well, so The Big Short was the one, I mean, okay, football, baseball, that's one thing. What did you think? So they're faced with this challenge of trying to explain this fairly complicated thing, which you explain really well in the book. What did you think of their tricks? You know, like the explanatory moments in The Big Short where a girl in a bubble bath pops out and, you know, explains.
I thought they were great. When I heard Adam McKay was going to make the movie, I actually thought this is perfect. I think comedy is so hard to do. Mm-hmm. He does it so well. Mm-hmm. I think Talladega Nights is a work of genius. Mm-hmm. And we've watched it 5 times in our household. Uh-huh. And I thought the problem with the material is it is inherently a little dry.
You have to understand certain things to understand what the stakes are in the story, to understand why people are so worked up, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Yeah.
And you have to make people want to read it or see it. Mm-hmm. Too many people who are trying to communicate with audiences rely on their feeling deep inside that the audience should want to know about this. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly true with some of the subjects I deal with. And I knew Adam McKay wouldn't do that. He'd realize he actually had to make them want to see it. Like, mm-hmm. not should, but like, I want it. And it's entertaining. And he'd bring it to life. I thought the tricks were, they served this purpose, that they relieve the audience of having to think too much more about what a credit default swap was, knowing mm-hmm. that someone had tried to explain it to them. Mm-hmm. Now, whether they understood it or not was a different thing, but they didn't really, at that point, they knew that they could engage fully with the characters and what the characters were up to mm-hmm. as a result of that. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. And the performances, I thought, were incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give you a little example. One of the things that I've come to, from a distance, Hollywood looks like nonsense. It's actually filled with unbelievably talented people who are largely craftspeople. Mm-hmm. And not a lot of people who do all the stuff you don't see, but also even the actors and the directors. Christian Bale. Christian Bale played Michael Burry, who was the Asperger-y hedge fund manager with a glass eye who couldn't relate to people, who I spent a year living with to get him on the page. It took me forever to kind of get him down on the page. Christian Bale spent a day with him, 12 hours, but it was a day, and put him on the screen in a way that made, he was indistinguishable from the character. And I asked him, I said, well, like, how did that happen? You spent a day, I spent a year, and you picked up things that I couldn't have described. And he didn't want to talk about it a little bit, but then I got him to talk about it. And he said, well, you watch him for a while and you see what the key to the whole character is. He said, he breathes, it's the way he breathes. What? He says, he breathes in the wrong spots in sentences. And that leads to all this like herky jerky discomfort. And as long as I was breathing the way he breathed, I was in character.
And see, that's like, brilliant.
It's absolutely, you're dealing with people who are really good at what they do. And so I've always felt, is it better or worse than the book? I don't think of it that way. I think, did it succeed in its own terms? And I felt all the movies have succeeded in their own terms.
I agree.
And I've been so lucky with the hands it's fallen in, they've fallen into. With the only caveat to that is, I don't think the books would have fallen into really bad hands because they're such a pain in the ass to make into movies. You have to really have to want to work at it to do these books into movies. So it attracts someone who's ambitious.
You know, you're writing about Danny Kahneman. Do you just, like, you walk in and you say, hi, I'm Michael Lewis, I'm going to move into your house for 4 years.
You got to hold hands before you kiss.
Right.
You don't.
No, but I've always been, like, you know, we work with characters, we have depth, but this is years of sort of living with the widows or living with his wife. How do you sidle up to that? Is it a slow process, or do you just jump into the bed with them?
That's what you have to do in the end.
Right.
But if you said that, they'd never do it.
Right.
Right. They have to want to do it. To the extent there's any trick to it, it's not to be pushy about it. Mm-hmm. I start with a curiosity. I try to interest them in what I'm interested in. And then if I can find ways to be useful to them, while I'm working on the book.
What do you mean? Like take out the trash? Like what does be useful mean?
Take out the trash. It's not a bad idea. But yeah. Moneyball was a really simple example. Billy Bean had this lab rat, this lab experiment going, and these lab rats were his players. And he told me right away in the very beginning when he was explaining to me why they were playing so-and-so at first base and why so-and-so was leading off and why they had these people on this field, that there's some math to it, there's some analysis to it. We don't tell the players, it just confuses them. So don't you tell the players. And
you told the players.
I told the players. So I went and the players, I would go down, I'd tell each one what the theory of him was, and they were absolutely riveted, and they started telling me all kinds of stuff that Billy Bean wanted to know about what was going on in the clubhouse. So these people, they're just guys who don't talk. Uh-huh. And so I would go back. I was the bee pollinating the flowers. I would go back and forth and back and forth. And so I became useful to them. Uh-huh. And then they just say, there was a point, my second child was born in the middle of me while I was working on Moneyball. And Billy says he looked up after a few days I wasn't there. He said, where's Michael? He's supposed to be here. Right. And so I became kind of like almost like an employee in the organization.
Uh-huh.
So that, with Danny Kahneman, the Undoing Project starts. It doesn't start with me thinking I want to write a book about these two Israeli psychologists. It starts because I get, well, should I explain how it actually started? I had to back, with Danny though. So the what had happened was Moneyball came out. And right after it came out, you know, I thought I had written a story that was chiefly about how people are misunderstood, how markets misvalue people. And if they can misvalue a professional baseball player when there's millions of dollars at stake and what they're doing on the field has millions of people watching, you know, when they're on the job, their stats attached to everything they do on the job, if that person could be misvalued in the workplace, who can't be misvalued. There came a review of the book by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein, an economist and a lawyer, who basically said Michael Lewis didn't understand what his story was about. His story really shouldn't have been about the fact that people are misvalued in this way. It should have been about why. What's going on in the human mind, in the mind of the people who are doing the misvaluation? And these two Israeli psychologists, Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky.
Which you had never heard of.
Never heard of them. Never heard of him. Even though Kahneman, while I was working on Moneyball, had won the Nobel Prize in Economics. And Tversky, it turned out, was the father of my favorite student when I taught at Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
I taught a term, and his oldest kid was in my class, and I loved him. And we got to dinner whenever he was in town, but I never thought Orrin Tversky. I never heard the name. And I went up to see Danny Kahneman, not right away, a few years later. It turned out that he lived up the hill from me in Berkeley in the summers. And right away, I became useful to him because he was working on a book that he said was going to destroy his reputation. He said, I've sold this book. He was in agony when I met him. I sold this book, and I've written some of it, and it's so bad, it's going to destroy my reputation, so I don't know what to do. I may just give back the money. I'm throwing it away. And I said, could I see some of it? And he gave me some of it. And I read it. And I thought, this is not going to destroy it. This is unbelievably interesting. And this book ends up being called Thinking Fast and Slow and sells 5 million copies.
Right.
And so it was, the relationship had nothing to do with me writing a book about him. But the relationship.
Did you know you were going to write a book about him at that point, or you were just wanted to meet him?
I just wanted to meet him. I was curious what I'd missed. And I went and looked at the papers, and these people had engaged in this project, which is actually riveting, I thought, and still think, of trying to figure out how people deal with uncertainty, how people make judgments and decisions, how people, instead of calculating the odds of situations, tell a story about a situation that leads them to a decision.
All right, let's go. Bracket us 10 minutes here to actually talk about this, because yeah. I'm really, really interested in it. So most people think that the conclusion is people are stupid or they're biased. Like, that's how this research is described. That's not what it's about.
No.
Right?
No.
The interesting thing, I think I understand this correctly, is the bias is systematic. Like,
yes.
You can track the bias. That's what's important about it.
It's predictable mistakes. That people make.
Right.
And they were seeking to dramatize and demonstrate with scientific studies the kinds of mistakes people make and then classify them. It didn't start as a grand project.
Can we give one example of a systematic mistake?
Sure. Here's a fun one. It's an easy one. Okay. Some of them are more easily done on the page than on a stage, but. An easy one is one of the things they noted, and they were always starting with themselves. There are two Israelis in Israel, in and out of the army, in and out of government, advising, you know, in and out of life.
And basically operating like a married couple.
Better than married couple because they were in love.
Right.
You know, they were passionately in love the whole time.
Right.
Until they busted up. I mean, they were more like they're having affairs with each other.
Right.
And their wives sensed it.
Yeah.
Danny actually says this about it. At one point he turned to me while we were on a hike in the Berkeley Hills. He says, what you don't understand is the feeling. He said, you're in love with women and all that. He said, but with Amos I was rapt. And Amos loved me more than I loved him. It is that kind of feel. I mean, it was incredibly intense. They're just kind of playing around. Like, what mistakes do we make? What mistakes do we see people make? And one of the things they'd picked up was that how easily you could distort someone's judgment and decision by introducing a completely irrelevant piece of information at the front end of the decision or the judgment. And they built a wheel of fortune with 100 numbers on it, 1 to 100. And they'd bring subjects into a lab and have them spin the wheel of fortune. And it would land on one of the numbers. And then after it landed on a number, they'd ask the subject, what percentage of the countries in the United Nations are from Africa? Like, nothing to do with the Wheel of Fortune. The people who spun 99 on the Wheel of Fortune guessed a higher number of countries in the United Nations came from Africa than people who spun 1. That their judgment of that question was completely distorted by a number that was thrown up front.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who does that sound like? I mean, that's one little example, but that kind of captures the spirit of the work.
And it's not because the people are stupid or don't know their statistics. It's because they kind of get attached to that random number that they spun
people,
to, or because they create a story related, or they just have highness
in their
mind.
It's in their heads. They never explain it. Why? They make a point of not addressing the question. Why are people making mistakes? They actually never use their word irrational until quite late in there. Why are these errors committed? What they would say is, though, I think, is that what people are doing, people are storytelling machines and pattern recognition machines, and they see patterns even when the patterns are meaningless. They see meaning in the patterns. They'll create patterns even where patterns aren't there, and they'll arrange things into a story, into a narrative that will lead them astray. But they decided there's no point in even trying or interest in trying to answer the question of why we are wired to mm-hmm. make certain kinds of mistakes. The point was we can demonstrate that we are wired for certain kinds of mistakes. And if people are, this has implications for lots of things. Let me give you one other example, because that one sounds like just kind of like fun. Here's another one. They one of their insights is that when people are deciding between things, they're not deciding between things. They're deciding between descriptions of things. And if you just describe the decision, the same decision in a different way, you'll get a different result from the person. And most dramatically, they tested this out, Amos tested this out on doctors at Stanford, in the Stanford Hospital. He presented them with patients who had terminal cancer and were given 7 years to live. And a surgery, a procedure that was innovative and risky, that you could put them into surgery right now, and if there would be, he told one set of doctors that if you perform this procedure, they'll be cured of cancer, but the risk is they die on the operating table. He told one group that there's a 90% chance that the patient would survive the operation, and the other group that there was a 10% chance they would die in the operation. I mean, it's the same thing. The group that was given the survival statistic, the 90%, were twice as likely to perform the operation. I mean, when you're dealing with matters of life and death with experts. So right. They did this over, this kind of stuff, it's impish, over and over and over.
So once you dove into it, did you just start to see it everywhere? Like, did you notice your own biases? You write about medicine. Where else is it? Is it literally everywhere?
When I'm driving down the road in the highway in Northern California, I usually go about 75 miles an hour, and then I see an accident. And for the next 6 hours, I'll go, maybe not 6 hours, 3 hours, I'll go 55 or 60. I have just changed my judgment about the probability of me being in an accident based on having seen an accident. My memory has warped my sense of the odds.
And that's because vivid, immediate memories tend to
work. One of their general, they call it the availability heuristic, but they're talking about memory, the way memory distorts judgments of the odds. And they create series of tests to show how this works. But yes, and
I was thinking about parenting culture when I read that. Like how wildly parenting culture has shifted in 30 years, probably based on, you know, in the 70s when the reporting of certain child abductions became so prevalent and vivid in our minds and news spread so much more quickly that it just changed our sense of
safety.
We're
always responding to the last tragedy.
Yeah.
We're not calculating the odds in any way. We're responding to whatever just happened. Katrina hits New Orleans. New Orleans is paralyzed with fear of another hurricane and for the next few years, and now everybody's forgotten about it. Nobody's thinking New Orleans is going to be hit by a hurricane. But it's you see this over and over and over. So we digress because we had them in a room. The thing that got me into the book, it wasn't a book right away. What it was I was talking about to Danny about his book, and he starts talking to me about this love affair and the ideas that came from the love affair. And it became very clear to me at some point, the ideas don't happen without the love affair. That the work they do together is unlike the work they do apart. It doesn't happen. It is a pure collaboration. The collaboration is totally necessary, and there were interesting emotional dynamics between the two men that enable for the collaboration to happen, even though they're extremely, very different people. And I realized I had that kind of emotional core of a story. It interested me. I thought that's an odd love affair. Mm-hmm. Because there really isn't a whiff of sexuality about it, but it felt sexual in every other way. And it was asked, you know, I was asked by the Hollywood Reporter 2 months ago, could you give us the one-line movie pitch for the book you're working on? And I said, it's Brokeback Mountain, but they f*** each other's ideas. And that is what it is. That's what it was. And so,
did you think of that on the spot? That is just genius.
No, but so I had an emotional narrative, and that made me feel something, and the ideas would spin out. I could work around that. So I decided there was a book in this, probably kind of like 2009, 2008, 2009, and then there were these hurdles. I didn't think, and you can probably understand why I didn't think, that I was qualified to be writing about psychology or about Israel in the early days. And Israel in the early days was the backdrop of the book. I mean, you remember, I don't know, maybe were you there at the New Republic when I wrote a piece called Toy Goy about how I was always the goy in the presence of Jews,
right,
but never the Jew. And so I felt I was dealing with material that was not my material. It didn't feel like my material.
Right.
It felt like Malcolm Gladwell's material.
Right.
And so I didn't think it was I should be writing. And I had this other sense, very vivid, that I told Dan. I explained to Danny my hesitation is that I think all of my books, when I walk into sports or Wall Street or parenting, whatever it is, I'm pretty much a B student writing about other B students. Or at least if they're A students, like the people in The Big Short are really smart people, but they're in a kind of C student environment. I don't feel like the environment's smarter than me. I don't feel like I can get my mind around it. I had two characters I knew I wasn't ever going to be able to completely get my mind around. That their minds were bigger than my mind. And that was uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And it was only what happened was I did so much work on this thing not knowing it was a book. Piles like this rose in my office of material I gathered, and I would say to the publisher, I don't think I'm going to do this, when they'd ask about it. I made 4 trips to Israel, each longer than a week, before I actually committed to doing the book.
What was the hesitation that the material?
I wasn't qualified to do it. Uh-huh. That it wasn't my material. And it wasn't that it wasn't a great story. I just thought, I'm not going to be able to pull this off. And what eventually happened was the people I required to tell the story were largely people who were now in their 70s and 80s, and a lot of them in Israel, academics here too. And people who I'd interviewed in 2008 or 2009, kind of in my exploratory stage, started to die. And I realized that the story's just going to vanish without being told. And it's such an important story. Mm-hmm. And I now had I was kind of entrusted with it in some way. And I had Danny willing to open up to me to the extent he was willing to open up to anybody. And the Tversky family willing to just give me everything they had. So I had privileged access to the story. So I figured, all right, someone's going to do this eventually because it's a really important, it's a moment in the history of science, in the history of the understanding of human nature. And when they do it, because the resources aren't going to be there, it's going to be bad. If anybody's going to write a bad book about it, it might as well be me.
So that's a really good selling point. You should put that put that on the blurb. I have to say, like, merely the fact that you're interested in something makes something interesting. Like, you just have a gift for explaining things which are fairly complicated at a level which respects the complication of the thing, but which everybody else can somehow understand. That's very hard to do. Most people have to make a choice. They either dumb it down or they sail over everybody's heads, but you do neither of those things in any of your books.
I don't want to try to seem smarter than my reader because I don't feel smarter than my reader. Mm-hmm. And I want my reader to feel smart. Mm-hmm. I had a moment. This will come across wrong in the retelling, and maybe even in the telling it doesn't come across quite right. But I got myself in a groove towards the end of this book. The end of the book came gushing out of me in a speed that I almost never write. And I write pretty fast. And it came out in a way.
From their breakup or from?
From the breakup to the end of the book when Danny is notified of the Nobel Prize. And when I finished the book, I had this moment. I don't feel this way now, but I had this moment. I walked in and my wife, who is not, I mean, she's always a little wary of whatever I'm writing about. She's not my biggest fan.
Intellectually.
I said, I just had this feeling that I just wrote the best book I've ever written. And not only that, I think it might be the best book anybody's ever written. And she said, she said, don't say that and don't think it, you know. And that feeling dissipated. And now I don't feel that way at all anymore about it. But when I finished it, I thought, I had a sense of all the different moving parts in the book. Mm-hmm. I was trying to solve a Rubik's Cube. And it was that moment where it's all the colors in the right place. I just went, whoa, it worked. So I did have that feeling. Mm-hmm. It was a very interesting exercise. It was unlike a lot of the books because I did spend 8 years gathering stuff for it. That doesn't ever happen with me. I was writing about things that were kind of alien to me. And it felt inherently alien to me. But it felt okay.
Wait, are you still interested enough that I can ask you one more question?
You can ask me whatever you want.
Okay, good, because I have a question I'm really curious about. So here's the puzzle for me about the Kahneman-Tversky work, is that
it's so beautifully humanizing at one level. Like, it acknowledges us as human beings in all our flaws, the way our minds are working. I feel like it's very accepting. On the other hand, the natural conclusion of their work and of a lot of your work is give the world to the algorithms. Like, we just can't do anything right.
Well, there's basically some problems. Well, the opening of the book is someone grappling in the basket, the front office of the Houston Rockets. This GM who thought he was going to take it to the machines, realizing that even he, who is on the extreme end of that movement, is maybe the tip of the spear of that movement now, can't do that. That the problem is never going to go away because you're always having to reintroduce human judgment, even after you've got this highly mechanistic process.
Which is what I feel like we're learning now. Like, the algorithms are tainted. Like, the algorithms are limited.
Because the algorithms are created by people, and they will, the algorithm is not going to have all the information it needs all the time. Mm-hmm. And the trick is figuring out what the human's good at and what the algorithm's good at. The machine is better than the human at some things, so it's sort of like finding that sweet spot. So it's human. Their work is humanizing, and I think the great sort of like takeaway of their work. Is that we're wired for fallibility, and that error is not shameful.
Right.
It shouldn't be shameful. So what we should do is embrace this aspect of ourselves and work around it, rather than hide from it or bury it, and pretend that we're these infallible, great, intuitive judges of things.
Do you feel like that's what they felt about their work? Like, even Tversky, like, did he feel that way about himself or about humanity in general?
Danny is the embodiment of their work. Danny he is always looking for error, his own and other people's.
I couldn't tell from reading the book if he was depressed.
He is. He flirts with it and has had, I think, bouts of it.
Uh-huh.
But yes, but he's also has manic state. He's had manic state. He has uh-huh. ideas and he goes up and down. He's volatile, or was very volatile when mm-hmm. they were working together. And Amos was very steady. Amos actually, you know, it's funny that Amos ends up creating the vessel for Danny's ideas, because Amos himself, did not think of himself as a fallible person.
Right.
Amos Tversky operated the if there was a heuristic, it's that Amos is right about everything, there was the famous Dick Nisbet, the Michigan psychologist, designed the famous Tversky test, the shortest intelligence test ever devised, which was the longer it takes you to figure out that Amos is smarter than you after you've met him, the stupider you are. and I put that, nobody who I knew, who I interviewed, I don't know how many people, hundreds of people, everybody who knew him said, absolutely right. Absolutely terrifying mind. And so that he ends up being the person who structures this work so it can be consumed by the academic world is funny. But Amos thought other people were fallible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think he thought of himself as fallible.
Are you a Danny or an Amos?
So that's a funny question. No one's asked me that yet. But when the book went into the publisher, the publishing house, all the people in the publishing house were reading it, and their arguments broke out on whose side you were on. Because it was in the book, because it's a love affair, and they have a horrible falling out. Are you an Amos person or a Danny person? Who are you sympathetic to? And a pattern emerged. It was just a pattern. They were exceptions to it.
Women were to Danny, and men were the Amos.
Yes,
yeah.
Women were the Danny. And the line that jumped off the page to women and turn them to Danny people from if they're even flirting with being an Amos person, was when they're breaking up and Danny is hungry and needy for attention and affection and Amos isn't giving it to him, Amos writes Danny in a letter. There's a line in the letter, I don't get your sensitivity metric.
Adopt that line.
Yes, so anybody who can write that line essentially to a lover who they're in a brawl with is never going to get anybody's sensitivity metric, right? And many women know what it's like to be on the receiving end of that that sentiment. I don't get your sensitivity metric. that was the pattern. I prefer not to, I don't take a stand. When I wrote the book,
I wasn't asking who you like better. I was asking which one you were.
Oh, I have bits of both of them. Mm-hmm. I don't neatly map onto either one of them. Mm-hmm. And in writing the thing, my goal was, I was thinking about how this relationship would play with the audience, that I wanted people who would have known them, if they knew them, and would have been a Danny person, to be a Danny person at the end of the book, and people who would know an Amos person be an Amos person at the end of the book. I wanted it to say something about the reader, how they felt about the material. Mm-hmm. I probably more like Amos. I'm kind of a dumb Amos, which is not a good thing to be. think of me that way. I'm a less bright Amos. Because Amos was an optimist. He was upbeat. Amos said.
He was confident.
Danny was pessimistic and dark, and Amos would say to Danny, not only am I not a pessimist, you're stupid to be a pessimist, because when you're a pessimist, you live it twice. Once when you're worrying about the bad thing happening, and the second time when the bad thing happens. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen.
Right.
So it's just like, it's not an optimum strategy for life. I'm much more like that. Amos is an easier character for me to access, which is odd. So, well, I mean, I hate to go on and on, but one of the things, the little roadblocks in my mind on the way to getting myself into the headspace to write the book was Amos was dead. He died in 1989. I've never had a dead character. It's my first, and I thought, how am I going to...
Was his wife your access to him, basically?
Amos Tversky, it was more complicated than that. My fear was Danny was going to seem alive and Amos was going to seem dead when I wrote about him. And I think, if anything, the reverse is true.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're not living on the earth where you actually know the outcome, you're reading the book thinking the odds are so against Danny,
right,
and yet he's the name we all know.
Right.
And he's the person.
Right.
And not because Amos is dead. It's just because, I don't know why.
Amos is dead. Because Amos died, and you don't get the Nobel Prize if you're dead.
Who would have written, would they have written the book together?
No. They would have fallen out. If Amos had not, they had broken off the friendship. Danny had broken off the friendship 2 days before Amos found out he had cancer. And Amos died 6 months later. They were then reunited. I don't want to tell everybody the end of the story, but Amos.
You just did.
But Amos, no, not completely. Amos was such a strong personality. He's such a clear signal. He still sends signals from the grave. Because Amos never did anything he didn't want to do. He never said anything he didn't mean. He didn't spend time with anybody he didn't want to spend time with. He didn't save anything he didn't want to save. He was a great chucker-outer of things. Amos would tell people, I mean, so he had a, so the short, the long answer is, Barbara Tversky, his widow, said the file cabinets that Amos kept all his stuff in are still in the hallway outside of his office in Stanford. This is 20 years later, or whatever, 15
because
years later.
Because they revere him so much, or?
I don't know. I did find there was this pattern that anything physical Amos had left behind, and he didn't leave much. He really got rid of a lot of material stuff from his life. People clung to like relics from a saint. People had his old stapler or his old laser pointer or old pictures. They were still all there. Nobody wanted to lose him. Everybody wanted Amos alive and wanted to remember him. He was so important the way people thought about the world. They needed to preserve him. Mm-hmm. Nobody had been through these file cabinets. And Amos, I knew by the time I got to the file cabinets, I knew that, for example, when Amos got his mail, half of it, he didn't, even if it were letters from people, he just chuck them. And he wasn't interested in reading it, he didn't read it. And he certainly didn't save anything. So what he saved was precious. It was like Amos talking to me.
If you guys read the book, there's a great point in the book where sort of all of their principles are summarized on a ripped out piece of paper that I think is one of the things he saved that Danny had given to him. And maybe I'm getting
that
slightly wrong.
No, he saved that he wrote.
That he had written out all the sort of basic principles of what they both believed.
It looked like a poem on the page.
Yeah.
It was just a loose sheet of paper that he had saved. So, yeah. And their breakup letters were in there. He saved it. Danny had nothing. Danny had lost every scrap of paper he had in the Oakland fire. His house had burned down. But Amos had all this stuff. And that and the vivid memories people had of him made him very, very easy to access and to draw. So it ended up being, and Danny, on the other hand, Amos, as much as Amos wanted to be known, if he wanted to be known by you, and everybody felt they knew him, Danny did not want to be known. And Danny kept his distance. I mean, this is a man who, as a child, spent 4 years hiding from Nazis in barns in France. It's not hard to dream up a story about why he was so evasive, but he is still evasive. Mm-hmm. Does not like to be pinned down. Anything you say about him, even if he said it about himself, he will then contradict in some way. So he makes it he becomes much harder to draw, amorphous. Nothing's ever stable. I think the lights are blinking.
They are. We're going to take questions now. Why were none of the Wall Street felons of Goldman, et cetera, why weren't they prosecuted and sent to jail? Boom. Give us the answer.
Are you going to edit these? Or just?
Yes, I'm going to edit them.
Just because, I mean, this is...
Because you don't know.
No, it's a complicated question to answer, but at least part of the answer is what was diabolical about the financial crisis was how much that happened was legal. And how much of it was a problem of a failure of the right rules to be in place. But part of it, I mean, if you thought broadly about possible criminality, things like insider trading could have applied in the bond markets. A law that's routinely brought to bear under the stock markets is never brought to bear in the bond markets. Places like Goldman Sachs had inside information on what was going on with actual mortgages that they used to trade bonds with, and nobody seemed to care about that. But that, you know, the attempt there was, I don't know if you remember, when Bear Stearns come crashing down and the crisis starts to develop, there was an attempt to throw people in jail. The Justice Department went after those two guys who ran the Bear Stearns fund that went down. And not only were they acquitted, but jurors afterwards were quoted in the paper saying, how do I get in touch with those guys so that I can give them my money?
Well, the movie makes it pretty clear. The movie makes the answer clear, too. I mean, like, even in the movie, they managed that, the kind of toothlessness of the accountability system.
And the other problem was the administration that rolls in to deal with the financial crisis, it was fog of war. I mean, once they decided that they weren't going to break up the institutions and restructure the industry, it was all about preserving it. And there was a natural hesitancy to start to criminalize. Mm-hmm. Too big to jail.
There has been for a long time.
No, and the fact that none of that happened, that's the seeds of the Trump phenomenon. It's amazing that he's the product of it, but the anger birthed by the injustice, the inherent unfairness of what happened in 2008, that these people behaving badly and failing get propped up, and they're elites in the society who went to the best schools, have all the advantages, and are paid the most money, they're going to get the government's help, they're going to be propped up. That generates a rage,
right?
And that rage is palpable today,
right?
And that's part of what you're seeing.
All right, there's a lot of interest in the blind side in these questions, especially from the 11th graders. We have Avery. What's your favorite part of the blind side?
My favorite part of the movie or the book? You want me to... My favorite...
We'll say the story.
So from a literary... when I go back and look at the book, I really like the opening of that book with Lawrence Taylor. The forces... That book, the structure of that story... All stories have structure. And the structure of that story, when I realized it was a story, was what are the forces in the world that turn this 15-year-old homeless African-American kid, illiterate homeless African-American kid, from the least valued person in the society to one of the most? And one of the forces was something that had happened in football, that he was naturally suited to exploit, and the opening of the book with Lawrence Taylor breaking Joe Theismann's leg and scaring the hell out of NFL strategists everywhere, lifting the value of this position this kid could play, and it was a really fun, pretty thing to write. My favorite part of the whole story is clear. It's the relationship. It's the other force is a mother. Is the relationship between this family and this kid. I remember crying as I wrote the book, crying as I heard the stories. And this idea the kid is given his bed, and he actually looks down and he says, I've never had a bed. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just absolutely perplexed by the fact he has a bed.
How did you choose that story? That's another question.
Kind of chose me. I was in Memphis where the story unspooled in 2004 or 5. And I was writing about, I wanted to write a story about my high school baseball coach, which ended up being a little book called Coach. And I thought, before I write this story, I really should talk to some of my teammates to see if they felt the same, how they felt about it. It isn't just me talking. And one of the teammates I thought would be interesting on the subject was a kid on my team whose dad had had a stroke and who had the coach had become kind of a father to him. And that kid was Sean Toohey, who was the father of the family who adopted the kid. Uh-huh. And I hadn't seen Sean since high school. And I called him up saying, I want to come talk to you about this. And he picked me up at the airport. And on the way to his house, he said, so I got a question. He said, who writes your books? And I said, I mean, we had been kind of very close friends when we were 8, 9, 10, 11. And then we kind of drifted apart. But he was the catcher on the baseball team. I was the pitcher. And he goes, so who writes your books? And I said, I write my books. And he goes, don't give me that. Who writes it? Who puts the words on the page? I mean, he goes, I know your name's on the cover, and your name sells them, but who writes them? And I said, Sean, no, I really write the words. And he goes, you are dumb shit just like me in the back of the English class. There's no way you write those books. It took me the whole of the drive to his house to explain to him that I actually wrote these books. So we get to his house, and I mean, Sean is a great, he was always a great character. He was a character in my imagination when I was a kid. But he takes me to his house, and I spend an hour, hour and a half at his house, and there is a 6'5", 300-pound black kid on his sofa who he does not introduce me to or explain in any way. I think he thought that was funny. And on the way back, I said, so who is the kid? And he said, we just took him in. He's Leanne's new project. She said, we found him on the street. He was on the street. He didn't have a home. He ended up in a weird way in our kid's school, and he can't read. She's trying to fix it. And I just started following the story. I did not think I was going to write about it. I mean, and my wife, Tabitha, knocked me over the edge on the story. He came out. Sean was the color commentator, among other things, for the Memphis Grizzlies basketball team. And he would travel with them. So when they came play the Warriors in Oakland, he'd stay with us. And we went out to dinner, and he started telling the stories about trying to raise this kid. And we came out of the dinner, and he went his way, and we went ours. And my wife, I'd been making noises about maybe this is a story, and this is the first she'd heard about it. She said, you are an idiot if the next thing you do is not write that book.
She was absolutely right.
She was absolutely right.
All right, a quick last one. Sorry, I know you said to stop. But we haven't talked about Flash Boys. Any positive changes caused by Flash Boys? I asked because someone I met earlier said you've changed their investing, the way they invest, and I wonder if you think that's generally true.
Well, what is true is, and the people at the heart of that story, which is a story of just a nice guy from Canada who comes to Wall Street and figures out the stock market's rigged. And it's rigged in a very peculiar, arcane way, but it's outrageous that it happens. And he wants to build an exchange where investors are safe and treated fairly. That exchange required the approval of the SEC. And some months ago, after a long, unnecessary slog, they got the approval, and he says that wouldn't have happened without the book. The book, because no one would have cared. They wouldn't have been felt. The SEC wouldn't have felt observed and watched while this was happening. Now the market, it's responding in all kinds of odd ways. They're a very viable business. They're very profitable. They're still only a couple of percent of the stock market, but there's every possibility they're going to get to be a bigger part of that. And the other exchanges are all oddly introducing exactly their mechanism for preventing the scalp that goes on in the market. And that creates a curious situation. I mean, the New York Stock Stock Exchange just announced they're creating a replica of this exchange, the IEX exchange, and leaving all their other exchanges exactly the way they are, and they announced that they're doing it because it will help protect investors. But what the hell is going on the other exchanges then? You know?
Right.
I mean, the whole thing, that there's anybody who actually digs into this material will get more, find themselves getting angrier and angrier and angrier. The response to the book was, for me, a premonition of this last presidential election. The ability of high-frequency traders to hire lobbyists, to hire PR firms, to put out false, kind of really fake news, commissioned from academics, kind of phony studies showing that high-frequency trading was good, not a bad thing, you know, showing the supposed scalp that I talked about didn't exist, all that stuff. The level of dishonesty that was accepted and not fought back by the media really much amazed me. I thought the situation was going to correct itself once everybody knew. That people would be so angry about it that it would just happen. And that's not what happened. What happened was vested interests had an incredible ability to preserve their privilege and advantage. Some little things have happened, but
not enough.
Audience, you've been amazing. Join me in thanking Michael Lewis for entertaining and educating us. Thank you.
That was Michael Lewis in conversation with Hannah Rosen as part of a Literary Arts special event in 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.